Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
The collection of the National Archives we do regard as national security infrastructure, because if that were to be destroyed, you know, denied or manipulated, Australians would lose faith in all of those things which we would regard as national values, and it would be seriously disruptive to Australia's security.
G'day, and welcome to the National Security Podcast, brought to you by the ANU National Security College, with support from policyforum.net. In this episode, David Fricker, Director General of the National Archives of Australia, joins two of the college's resident historians, Dr. William Stultz and Associate Professor Sue Thompson, to talk about the vital role the National Archives plays in Australia's security. Before we get into it, we'd like to acknowledge the Ngunnawal people, traditional owners of the land from which we broadcast. We pay our respects to their elders past, present, and emerging.
So welcome, David Fricker, to the National Security Podcast. We've got you at a really fortuitous time because it's the 60th anniversary of the National Archives of Australia this year. And I know that also you'll be departing the archives soon. So we're very lucky to have you on the podcast. For those listening, I suppose it might be slightly unusual to hear us reaching out to the National Archives of Australia. It's not what we always think of when we think of the intelligence and national security agencies. But David comes to us with a career in national security, but also, you know, for myself and Sue as historians, archive institutions play a really pivotal role in helping us understand national security. So that's why we wanted to talk to David today. So David, welcome.
Thank you very much. No, it's great. It's great to be here. And as you say, it's nice to, as I come up to the end of my 10 years at the archives, it's a good opportunity for me as well to perhaps reflect and have some of these conversations with you.
No, thanks so much for joining us. I'd like to actually ask you just first up, if you remember at all, when did you actually first set foot in an archives?
Oh, my goodness. Well, it was during my time at ASIO, in fact, because part of my responsibilities, and just for everyone, I was at ASIO from 2002 until starting here at the archives in 2012. And part of my responsibilities there was what we called the public research area of archives, where we do the declassification work. So as part of my duties over there and, you know, visiting some of our Five Eyes as partners, in fact, it was an opportunity for me to visit the archives and just see how other jurisdictions do it. But behind your question, as I'm sort of, you know, humbled before two eminent historians, the answer is not very often. You know, I didn't really have much clue about what an archives were or, you know, what sort of issues are faced by an institution of the National Archives.
I know that I really got a thrill when I first stepped into the National Archives of Australia and got to, you know, handle all those old cabinet documents marked top secret. Sue, do you remember where the first archives would have been that you would have stepped foot into?
Actually, the first archives I ever stepped foot into were the British National Archives. It was known back then as the Public Record Office. Everyone would know it as the PRO. Everyone would talk about the PRO, and I think historians still do now, but it's now called the National Archives. And it wasn't until a few years later that I actually stepped foot into the Australian Archives, having started my research work in the British Archives. And that's quite an amazing place, the British Archives. It's extremely rich with information.
So, David, much of what we publicly know about Australia's national security institutions, particularly our intelligence agencies, is actually kind of largely based on the historical information that's contained in places like the National Archives. So how seriously then do you take the National Archives role as helping Australians to understand what intelligence agencies are doing in the name of Australians? And would it be fair to say that the National Archives actually helps exercise, you know, a degree of oversight of security agencies, or do you kind of think about it a little bit differently?
No, I think you're absolutely right. You know, when people think about access to information, especially in Australia, but in most, you know, of our sort of Western democracies, people think about access to government information is generally people think of freedom of information legislation or right to information in other jurisdictions. But certainly in Australia, I mean, our intelligence community agencies are exempt. They're wholly exempt from the provisions of the FOI legislation. And while there is, of course, you know, various oversight mechanisms for our intelligence community with parliamentary committees, the Inspector General of Intelligence and Security, by and large, you're not going to be able to, you know, exercise any right of access to the records of our intelligence communities other than the Archives Act. So in the Commonwealth of Australia, it's that piece of legislation, the Archives Act, which is the only mechanism that Australians have to access the records of our intelligence communities. And as the National Archives being the organisation that, operationalises that act, this institution is the only way that those records will see the light of day. So it's vitally important, I think, for that sort of transparency and openness that we do have in Australia, that an institution like the Archives exist. And, you know, it's pretty good legislation, I'd have to say, internationally speaking. The Commonwealth Archives Act does give people a universal right of access to information that would otherwise remain hidden forever.
So I also want to follow up on that, David. That process of, when the records of a security or intelligence agency is before the minister, I assume generally the Attorney General, for being potentially declassified, and because I believe it's the concerns about our relationships with foreign countries is often a reason why certain material held by agencies might be kept secret. Does the Archives actually get to have a role in advocating for transparency when those decisions are being made, or is it really just a decision that's kind of left to the relevant minister and the relevant agency?
No, it's and this again is something almost unique in the world, that it is in fact the Archives. So it's in fact my office, the office of the Director General of the National Archives, that makes a decision about whether or not a record should be released under the Archives Act. So in very general terms, we have the 20-year rule. So after a record is 20 years old, then by default, it should be made publicly available unless a number of exemptions apply. And it's the role of the Archives and the role of my office and those with a delegation from my office to actually make that decision, to determine whether any exemption would apply to the release of that record. So you know, use the word advocate, and we do. You know, it's within the Australian system, the natural tendency for any public servant, if I could say that, but the natural tendency for any policy agency or a national security agency would be to keep a record, you know, secret. You know, from the point of view, if you're there to run operations, to provide security advice, to gather intelligence, then really there's nothing much to be gained by you releasing those records. It is the institution, the National Archives, that advocates for the release of that record. And so our position is to release everything we possibly can in those records, but limited, of course, you know, by the fact that none of us, and it's enshrined in the legislation, none of us want to release information that would be, you know, adverse to the interests of Australia and Australia's collective security. So it's very much that role. And it's not a power exercised by a minister, it's a power exercised by a public servant in the office that I currently occupy.
How do we go about the process of the releasing of information? So on the one hand, the legislation is there under the Archives Act, and of course there are often caveats to do that where other acts can come into play in terms of keeping information under historical information under wraps. But the actual physical process, and this is often a situation that historians face when we go to the archives and we order information that can be released because it's past the 20-year rule, but hasn't been released yet. And it can be quite time-consuming because the audience is probably not familiar with this term, which is access examination. And so is it the archives that does the access examinations, or are the individual departments?
Yeah, so it's I'd love to talk about this. So I'm so glad you asked this question, especially for the National Security College, because I just think this is so it is so important to sort of talk about this, because it's a system that we should continually be examining and we should be continually improving. So the process is so you as a researcher would come to the look up our online finding aid, our record search system. On through our website, and you identify that there are some records related to a particular topic that you're researching, or it's cabinet documents coming up to the 20 years and they're ready for release, and there are some topics you really want to examine. So you want to see perhaps ONA's national threat assessment for Australia in the year 2002 or something like that. So what happens then is our examiners will get that record and commence the examination of that record. Now, this is a requirement of the legislation and there's a good reason for this. So under the legislation, we are required to also consult. We cannot make that decision unless we have consulted with the competent agency, with the policy agency, or in this case, to go to ONA today and say, okay, is there anything in this record that in today's security environment would be adverse to the interests of Australia? And as Will said before, there's a range of exemptions there, so it's it would undermine Australia's national security. So people might be saying, well, there are still sources and methods, there are still issues in there which remain sensitive to Australia's contemporary security environment, our landscape. So that's one thing. The other thing is, would the release of this record damage Australia's foreign relations? That's when, you start to come into, well, if this is foreign intelligence came into this record, then, does that confidentiality still apply today? And would the release of this, seriously, not just in a general sense, but would it seriously do harm to Australians' foreign relations? And so there we might always consult with Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, to sort of say in today's Australia, would the release of this record do that? And there are other exemptions for, personal, would this release affect someone's personal affairs? Would it affect their professional affairs, commercial in confidence, et cetera, et cetera. So they're the sorts of exemptions we look for. So, Sue, to answer your question, we do examine it ourselves. We have security vetted expert, some of them are quite long in the tooth because they have really good operational experience in these fields. So we have our examiners doing that with that security clearances and expertise, but we always consult with the relevant agencies because, the record might have been created 25 years ago, but its release has to be seen in today's context as well. So that's how that works, and that can take some time, you're right. Now, 93-94% of our requests are done within the statutory, consideration period. But sometimes if it's a piece of, intelligence work that was done, in particular around foreign intelligence gathering, then it may require us consulting with some of our Five Eyes partners or some of our other partners who may have still some equities in that intelligence that was gathered. And they may have sources and methods or whatever which intersect with that operation. It might be a counter-espionage case. And as we know, counter-espionage, that sort of work goes on for generations. You really have to be careful that you're not, by releasing records, even 20, 30, 40 years old, you're not now revealing something which would undo some apparatus that we currently depend on to maintain Australia's security. So they're the sort of considerations that do go on. And that's what the access examination is. It's our own examiners looking at it to test it, but we do consult. But honestly, you know, and I get pinged for this quite a lot, but, you know, the Archives is a pro-disclosure organisation. The spirit of the legislation is there as a balance against our visceral need for secrecy and ongoing, you know, don't never release anything. You know, the Archives has been set up and empowered and the legislation has been done to make sure we release as much as we can. And we do. You know, we release about 98% of records are released without any redaction. And I think less than 1% of records are completely withheld after 20 years. And then whatever's, you know, left, another 1% might have some paragraphs or sentences or names in the records redacted. So it's that's sort of the process that we go through. And you know, while 20 years is pretty good, and that's become the international standard, Australia was at the front of the pack here, but the UK are copying, you know, they're following on that that example. Other jurisdictions around Australia, the states, are also moving from a 30-year rule to a 20-year rule. And the other thing, could I say there, actually, just comparing it, say, with the UK system, and in fact, most jurisdictions in the world, it's not the National Archives that decides what gets released. It's the ministries, it's the departments, the originating agencies. So in the case of the UK, it's MI5, you know, the security service would say, okay, this year we're going to release these records. You know, nobody gets a say in that. It's the agency that determines when it's safe to release records. In Australia, it's for the public to step forward and say, no, we want those records. And it's for an honest broker in the middle, like the National Archives, to say, all right, well, we're going to advocate, again, to use your term, Will, we're going to advocate on your behalf to release the maximum of those records. And because we are at the leading edge of this in Australia, we do, you know, there are some delays and we go before the courts sometimes or before the appeals tribunal to discuss what's been redacted and what's been released. But that's not a bad thing. You know, the fact that we're always in the public, you know, in the courts and tribunals, I think is a healthy thing, because you don't see that in other jurisdictions, because in other jurisdictions there's nowhere to go, you know, whereas in Australia people can exercise their rights in front of a tribunal.
I don't want to dwell too much longer on the declassification topic, because I know that the National Archives does get perhaps, I think, a degree of unfair publicity about it, because as you've kind of explained, there is actually a role for the other agencies to be playing in supporting the declassification process. So I did just want to ask quickly, do you think that the National Archives actually has enough authority to compel that assistance, that quite important expertise assistance from the departments and agencies to support the declassification process? Or are you kind of at the whims of how much time and resources they want to put into supporting declassification?
Look, it's you know, and this look, it's you know, and obviously because you guys are looking very carefully at national security and, you know, what the apparatus is for Australia's national security, and it's so I don't think it's not fair to, you know, to anyone to say, oh, look, you know, it's all subject to the whims and the, you know, we don't have enough power. It really does come down to you know, priority and resources, and so if we go to, you know, the Department of Foreign Affairs, and we say, look, somebody wants to look at, you know, there are 5,000 records in this series of Australia's foreign policy in country, you know, X, or towards current, you know, country X. And under the Act, you know, we've got 90 business days to respond to this request. And you go to the Department of Foreign Affairs, and the Department of Foreign Affairs are looking at Afghanistan at the moment. You know, they're trying to, you know, provide, you know, services to Australians, you know, stranded overseas or in the middle of some, you know, negotiation, they're heading up towards, you know, some major event or something. Similarly with the intelligence, you know, agencies, you go to ACES and you say, all right, we've got to, you know, you've got to drop everything and look at this request for records. Well, ACES then got to kind of balance that with their priorities around operations that they're running, et cetera, et cetera. So it really does come down to a question of volume of requests, because there's no limit. You know, it's not like FOI. There's no practical unreasonableness for an archives request. These are public records, so there's no such thing as a vexatious request. They're here because they're here to be researched. So we welcome applications. So you get, you know, every year we might get 40,000 to 50,000 requests for the release of records. that's, you know, let's say 50,000. That's a, you know, a lot. That's 1,000 a week. And each one of those requests may contain, you know, hundreds or even thousands of documents to be examined. So it's not a case of power. I think it's a case of resourcing. You know, are we resourced enough to get through that? And the answer is, well, no, we're not. And the statistics prove that. You know, we always have backlogs that we're working up against. But the good news is, Will and Sue, the good news is that just in July, the government, you know, allocated another $67.7 million to the archives. And if there were four measures there, one of those measures was to boost our capability for this, to accelerate the declassification of records. And so it gives us a lot more resources, another 17, I'll probably get that number wrong, but I think there's something like another 17 ASL we could have on that task. But more importantly for us, it means better technology, you know, for secure connectivity to speed the efficiency up, perhaps some smart data analytics to actually, you know, digitize the records and then apply some technology to parse those records and surface those issues of security concern. You know, so we're really looking forward to achieving some efficiencies and gains there.
So I want to shift to a different topic of discussion now, and I want to ask about how you think history and national memory, which archives are very important at sustaining, how those things interact with how we conceive of national security in Australia. So you'll be familiar with that famous kind of Donald Rumsfeld quote about 9/11 being like a failure of imagination. Do you think the imagination of national security agencies, is it captive to their past way of doing things? Or do you think deepening our appreciation of history in the past actually helps to avoid failures of imagination?
Well, of course, quite predictably, I'm going to agree with that second assertion. I mean, of course, it's the case. You know, we... you know, as a former ASIO staffer as well, I mean, I think there's a lot to be proud of in Australia's, you know, liberal democracy, the way our national security agencies conduct themselves and the standards that we're held to. And what part of the reason that, you know, we do set ourselves and maintain a high standard is because we know that we're all publicly accountable, you know, that the two have to go hand in hand. Without accountability and without transparency, you know, you are going to start to act with impunity and you know, there will be a drift. And this was what the Hope Royal Commission was all about. You know, it was a complete reset to sort of bring Australia's intelligence community onto that very strong footing that we still enjoy today. And that was about, that's what Hope brought to it. You know, it was about setting up a framework which was, as its foundation, was about accountability, you know, transparency and the appropriate level of scrutiny. And I think it's just essential for us to have a healthy, you know, if we use ASIO, use a security service. So, you know, we have an organisation which by law is permitted to spy on Australians and must operate, you know, under a veil of secrecy for it to remain effective. To you know, sustain our collective security, we need a security service that can spy on us to keep our security intact. But a part of that maintenance of collective security is for all of us to have some level of trust in what the security service is doing. And I think, you know, the maintenance of those essential records in a national archive and a framework to see those records released and made public without compromise to security is the way that you manage that balance between, you know, secrecy and openness, and that's the way you manage that trust in our security service, that, you know, we can trust that they need to do some things in secret, because from time to time we can open a window and just check that they are actually acting in our best interests. And I think, you know, that does give Australians greater pride in our system of government democracy. It gives Australians much more confidence that our intelligence community more broadly are acting in our best interests. And, you know, when the time comes for the intelligence community to seek the cooperation of Australians or even non-Australians, we have a much better chance of doing it, because it's that sort of soft power aspect of it. You know, people know that, okay, here's an organisation we can trust. And if I'm a foreigner, well, here's a nation I can actually trust. And, you know, we stand a much better chance of maintaining those and achieving those security outcomes. So I think it's just vitally important, you know. It's and again, it's a real strength of the Australian system. And I just you know, it needs to be sustained and it needs to be maintained. And as we get into the digital age, and, you know, the more sort of we deal with new complexities in the intelligence landscape, we need to keep our legislation operations up to date with that.
And on to the digital, actually, that leads into something that I've been thinking about, and this is very much for future historians. Myself, as a historian, the eras of history that I tend to delve into is the Cold War. That's the focus of my historical research, and all the sources that I dig up in the course of my research, and not just here in Australia, I go to archives in other countries too. It's all paper. It's all on paper and written with typewriters, which I think is eternally grateful, because I do remember when I was a PhD student at the University of London and I'd go to the British Archives and some people would be, you know, sitting next to you in the reading room and they'd be sort of opening up these scrolls of parchment paper with all this detailed writing, and I'd think, thank goodness I deal with typewritten writing. I don't have to decipher handwriting. However, into the future, and I also think to myself, thank goodness I'm dealing with pieces of paper, but into the future, government records are all in digital form. And I just wondered how the archives is managing to embrace the process of not just releasing of information, because on the one hand you've got the digitalising existing paper sources online, but how... what's the archives' role in trying to create a culture within the bureaucracy of saving electronic files for posterity?
Yes, well, no, and look, we've been there for a while, haven't we, Sue? I mean, the digital government has been, I graduated as a computer programmer, so my entire career with the Australian Public Service has been around the creation of digital records and digital information. So it is something which still presents challenges, you know, both from a legislative point of view and an operational point of view. And so for a long time now, that, you know, it's been clearly understood that our electronic records, if you like, are records and need to be kept. But what constantly challenges is the pace of change of technology is so rapid. And so most recently, in fact, it's been the move off government platforms onto non-government, you know, third-party platforms like, you know, just Signal, WhatsApp, you know, Telegram, these sorts of things, which is starting to cause some concern for me in, well, are we capturing the essential evidence of what's going on? So when we talk about a record, you know, we don't, you know, talk about a page of text. As you're saying, you know, we've got to move on from our definition in our mind of a record is no longer a document on a piece of paper, or a thing, you know, containing information. A record is just evidence, you know, evidence of what was actually done. So you think about records as evidence and as memory of what's happened. And so we, on the one hand, we're in a good place in terms of digital, the need, the legal need and the policy need and the policies and guidelines that we have out there are quite strong in terms of preserving the digital information that constitutes the evidence of what we've done as records. But where we're being challenged is on two fronts, is the scope of what constitutes an official record. You know, if you're using a personal laptop or an iPad or, you know, using a messaging service, we've still got to get that into the scope of what constitutes government records. And then the other one is preservation. So as you say, you know, you can go to an archive and read get a sheet of vellum with medieval Latin on it, and, you know, you can still access that document in the same way that the author would have accessed that document, you know, hundreds of thousands of years ago. But, you know, 100 years from now, will anyone be able to read WhatsApp messages, you know, or even sort of understand what Twitter, you know, how to sort of unpack a tweet or something like that? And so it's this thing about preservation. So we can capture it all and we can stick it on a server, but it's digital information is information on life support. If you turn your back on it for a short period of time, it will die. It'll become obsolete and unreadable. And so the challenge for us is digital preservation, which is a continuous process of keeping technology or the information up to date with current generations of technology. So it's a challenge. You know, it's a again, out of this recent funding announcement from government back in July, there's a healthy, there's $20 million or so dollars in there for us to upscale our digital archive for this very issue that you're raising, Sue, to make sure that we are actively preserving digital information and we're carrying that ahead, you know, through time. So every new technology cycle, we upgrade the information to make sure that it's still readable. But you've got to do that maintaining it as evidence. So you've got to maintain that chain of that evidence. So you can't convert a record from, say, a QuickTime or Adobe Flash to, you know, whatever the next format is without having a pretty good audit trail of how you did it and how you can guarantee that you still maintain the evidentiary quality of that record. The other thing is around attitudes of public servants in our case. You know, how do we maintain, and this comes back to your question, I think, Will, about, you know, the importance of history, because how do you maintain people's diligence in keeping a record of what they've done? Because, you know, and again, if we just think about national security, every day you might be really pushed very hard by the operational tempo of the day. But in the back of your mind, you've also got to remember you are making history here. You know, we need this information to learn, you know, for the future. We need this information to grow our body of resources, a primary source, you know, resources on which future intelligence will be derived. And so it's that attitude that information is important, that not only is what you're doing today and pushing out that transaction important, but the residual value of what you do, especially as an intelligence officer, the residual value of what you do is, you know, 50% what you're giving to your, you know, your manager today, but the other 50% is that information you leave behind and how useful is that information for the future. And that's the other part that we've really got to push hard in the archives to say that, look, as right across the Commonwealth, we are creating public information that can be trusted. And so this year we did launch our new policy for records management, which is building trust. It's called Building Trust in the Public Record, which means that all the work we do produces information that can be trusted and relied upon in the future for better decision making, more transparency of government, much more integrity in our operations, and that creates and contributes to Australia's collective memory.
Is there perhaps another dimension to this digital preservation piece, perhaps a more sinister one, which is actually the vulnerability of archival records to deliberate digital disruption? You know, or am I being perhaps a bit too, is that too much of a doomsday scenario to imagine, you know, foreign states deliberately trying to erase the servers of other countries' government records?
Yeah, no, look, I think it is. You know, when you think of what national, you know, what national security is, you know, what do we regard as our security? What are the things we hold most dear in Australia that we want to keep secure? And, you know, we might sort of think, you know, well, we value our democracy, you know, we value our freedoms, we value our access to justice. You know, we want to have an equal society, and we value our freedom of speech. Now, all of those things, you can't uphold those values unless you've got the records, you know, unless you have evidence. You democracy in Australia wouldn't function unless you could prove who is fit to stand for parliament. You know, we went through the whole Section 40, was it the constitutional sort of debacle a couple of years ago in parliament, who was fit to stand for parliament. Now, that was resolved by going to records, you know, for people to actually demonstrate the status of their nationality, of their citizenship. You know, records, the you know, access to justice depends on records. If you can't demonstrate who your parents were or when you arrived in Australia or your property ownership or all of these sorts of things, you cannot, you know, access justice. You know, we're talking about, you know, in the middle of a pandemic, we'll be talking about vaccination passports soon. And, you know, people's lives could be heavily affected by whether or not they can demonstrate that they've been vaccinated. Well, that requires a record. And so to your point, if you wanted to if you really wanted to damage Australia's national security, then you do. You know, you either manipulate, destroy, or, you know, replace the underlying evidence upon which we rely. And so the collection of the National Archives we do regard as this national security infrastructure, because if that were to be, as I say, destroyed, you know, denied or manipulated, then Australians would lose faith in all of those things which we would regard as national values, and it would be seriously disruptive to Australia's security. And then, you know, then there are the more, you know, obvious ones in terms of our defence. You know, the things we do need to keep secret, if you like, to maintain our sort of our defence, security, and our Australia's place in the world. So I know it is important. And then, and again, you know, to your thing, Sue, on digital, as more of that collective memory is held in digital form, it does become much more vulnerable to cyber, you know, to those cyber threats and cyber attacks. You know, when it was all on paper, it was very vulnerable to things like fire, infestation, and theft, because once it was gone, it was gone. We only had one copy, and, you know, it was out. So with digital, of course, we can keep multiple copies. Our business continuity is much better. But, you know, we are now living in the age of cyber threats. And that's where, you know, we have to be particularly vigilant about these covert intrusions into our national memory, because that would severely undermine our national security.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Around the world, democracies are in crisis. Leaders have become followers. Populists offer glib solutions to complex problems, and people search for answers. Block out the noise. Each week on Democracy Sausage, we go deeper to bring you insights from leading scholars, journalists, and commentators to help you make sense of the world. I'm Mark Kenny from the Australian National University. Join me at the Democracy Sausage Hot Plate every Monday and Thursday.
So I want to kind of continue on this, you know, building on this contested information environment that I guess you've highlighted that we exist in now. Is it kind of, in addition to that question of destroying or altering data and information, is also, you know, this problem of false narratives and conspiracy theories that can really circulate and damage trust in institutions? So thinking about that, you know, security agencies in particular have long been kind of the subject of often pretty wild and unflattering conspiracies. Do you think then we have the right balance when it comes to secrecy around these organizations? Or could more transparency, particularly concerning past activities, actually help dispel and address some of these conspiracies, and in turn kind of bolster public trust in what these national security agencies are doing?
Look, I think the more transparency, the better. You know, the more we can reveal, the better it will be. You know, because I do, you know, and this is why, you know, I think about resilience, that we can't, you know, for one, a big part of Australia's security about, you know, that how we are individually and collectively, how secure we are in being Australian and understanding, you know, what it means to be Australian in all of that, you know, plural, you know, forms. You know, we're not all sort of androids by any means. You know, Australia is a multicultural, you know, very tolerant, diverse community. But for us to have strength in our confidence about who we are, we do need to have a reliable knowledge of our history, you know, of what, you know, what wonderful things we've done in our past, what awful things we've done in our past, what have been our national successes, what have been our national failures. You know, what are we proud of? What are we ashamed of? And the more that we have a kind of a robust access to that understanding of our past, and the more that each one of us is empowered to actually talk about it with some authority and participate in that contest of ideas, then the more resilient we are, and the less vulnerable we are to foreign interference that would, you know, just put one narrative in place and try and sort of remove, you know, all of the sort of counter narratives. And I do think, you know, it relies on us being brave enough to expose, you know, those things in our past. And now, of course, you know, talking about national security, as I said at the outset, you can't be reckless about that. You know, you can't sort of do that in a way that, you know, disempowers Australia's security, you know, agencies from doing their work. But there is a good balance. You know, I think the history of ASIO, you know, the three volumes, I think is a good example of this. I think, you know, what we did there to sort of get, you know, those very eminent historians to get some security vetted and sort of come inside the organisation and have a look at those records, you know, and then sort of do the, you know, do the security sort of clearances at the end, you know, before publication, rather than censor the stuff that could go in to that historical research. Let the historical research see it all and then start sort of looking at, okay, what can be published out of that? Because you get a much more balanced, comprehensive view than if you tried to censor it all at the beginning. You know, only see a few primary sources and then publish something which is, you know, a fiction. It's just an opinion. So I think it is really important, and I think that's something that, you know, the archives can do, and it's not only the archives, but it's something that the National Archives can do as an institution and should do. And I reckon we ought to keep pushing ourselves harder and harder to do that, because honestly, I think the more Australians know, then the more committed we are to a vision for Australia, the more resilient we are against, you know, misinformation, disinformation. And, you know, I think the better our future will be. Because this is my other thing. I don't think, you know, you can't sort of build a fortress Australia. You can't stop misinformation, in my view. We just can't. You know, that horse is long bolted. You know, disinformation, misinformation is just a fact of life now, and it's only going to get worse. So all we can do is make sure that there is at least an equal volume of reliable information so that people can have a proper informed debate, you know, hear it all and make up our own minds about who we are.
In that vein, recently the Minister of Education came out in Question Time to say that our histories must be positive. I think he used the term patriotism and positive. I mean, how helpful is that? If we are scared to sort of be very open and honest about our history, does that make the country a bit vulnerable in terms of the sort of targets that we were talking about in terms of interference?
Look, I think, you know, I think that history can be patriotic. You know, I think that, you know, we can still produce, you know, I'm not a historian, right? And here I am talking to two historians, and I'm the archivist, all right? I'm just a keeper. But I think, you know, the patriotic thing to do is to engage in, you know, truth-telling. It is to sort of say, look, you know, whatever your thesis is as a historian, you know, when you're setting out to explore something, the patriotic thing to do, I think, is to make sure that you've considered all of the, you know, the available primary source material to make the arguments put forward as well-founded, as balanced as possible. So I don't sort of see a conflict there. I don't see it unpatriotic to engage in truth-telling and to you know, to look upon, you know, the deeds that Australia is committed, you know, as a nation or individually. You can look upon the deeds that we would judge very harshly today, as well as the deeds that we would, you know, applaud today. But you can still put that forward as something that makes us stronger, you know, going ahead. So that's how I would try and connect those things. I don't think, you know, a broad access to primary source material could ever be considered unpatriotic. You know, it would never be, if it was a proper, you know, balanced, you know, exercise in researching that primary source material, if it wasn't simply cherry-picking one side of the argument and deliberately ignoring the other, well, then I can't see how that would be unpatriotic.
Yeah, and that discussion that we're having about the whole issue of foreign interference in documents and how much we're targeted, it reminds me about the whole debates that we've had that have been had in the past about potential forgeries of documents. And I do know when you visit archives, not just here in Australia, but in other countries, I've been to a number of them, you're not allowed to take your bags into the archives, only pens and papers or a laptop, because there are many cases in the past of people actually stealing physical documents, and even cases of people stealing documents and forging them. So, you know, back to our conversation about the digital age too, it's a new challenge in terms of the manipulation of the digital information.
Yeah, no, it's very true. You know, there's a story when I was talking to my counterpart in the US, the National Archivist of the USA, that there was a case where a historian, some of this might be hypocritical, but he kind of built his career over a certain, you know, truth that he had pinged, and he found a document which kind of disproved it. And I think the story goes he actually wrote a different date on the document. So he didn't steal the thing, but as you said, he just wanted that date could not possibly be, you know, right. So he tried to alter the date on the original document. It is the case. And with digital, part of that is to, and this is part of our standards that we've issued under that policy of building trust in the public record, that, record keeping systems, in fact, any information system in the government has to be viewed as an evidentiary system. So information management really has to follow the rules of evidence as well as the information life cycle. And it's very important for that to be the case. The other thing about archives, of course, and as both of you would be well aware, that archives is about preserving series. You know, whereas a library, you know, is really we're collecting titles. In archives, we don't keep titles, we keep series of records. And that's, again, the power of primary source material is you can then corroborate whatever you find. And so in the information, this age we're currently in, where there are sort of millions and millions of records being created, and in the digital world, it's very hard to do anything, in fact, without creating records. So the trick for us is to preserve those records. The opportunity to corroborate those things becomes much better. And so if you know, there has been an individual document or record being manipulated or, altered or withdrawn, well, then through, you know, corroboration of within the broader context of those records, you would hope that those sort of anomalies would be picked up. Because, you know, we do keep reminding, you know, the archives, we keep saying, well, the archives are not necessarily a source of truth. The archives are a source of evidence, and it could be evidence of someone telling a lie, but it's evidence. And so it's everyone has to find their own truth. All the archives can do for you is provide some evidence upon which you can find, you know, you can navigate your thinking and you can find your own truth. And the other thing about history is also, I'd say, I keep saying, I think it was in last year's annual report as well, that people often would say, you know, the archives, you know, National Archives are keeping Australia's history safe. And I think we even said that once on one of our posters. But these days I say, no, my job is to make sure history is never safe. You know, we really have to make sure that every generation can have another look and actually, no, let's take a fresh view on this and maybe look at it through today's eyes and rewrite that history or, you know, improve that understanding of our history.
So, David, I wanted to ask you about the state of overseas archival institutions, because I note that in addition to being the Director General of the National Archives in Australia, you're also President of the International Council on Archives. So I imagine you've got a pretty good sense of the state and the condition of these institutions in an international context. It strikes me that for developing nations in particular, good archives are pretty critical to good democratic governance. Do you think that Australia could be doing more to help developing nations, particularly in the Pacific, where we have a strong interest, to strengthen archival institutions? Kind of, I guess what I'm kind of imagining is maybe is there something like an archive diplomacy campaign that we could be undertaking?
I really do. It's, the Pacific, you know, in fact, it's right now I'm preparing a talk. I'm doing a talk for a UNESCO Global Policy Forum on this very topic, actually, later on this month. And there is, you know, the Pacific island states, as we all know, are really, you know, they're under threat through the effects of climate change, you know, with severe weather events, rising sea levels. They do not have the funds to actually, you know, invest in infrastructure that can properly protect against those effects or be maintained, you know, at that sort of level. Just the geography of, you know, the Pacific Islands, you know, can make it difficult for people to actually visit, you know, an archive to actually use those materials and research it. And some of their social, and meanwhile, some of these social changes going on through globalization, through the, you know, emigration for work, you know, for whatever reason, but their cultural knowledge is under threat as well, because, you know, the sort of Western culture is sort of very, you know, dominating, and meanwhile the indigenous culture is very, very fragile, the memory of that. I was talking to a colleague of mine from Fiji, and at one point they wanted to inaugurate a new chief, and they actually found it quite difficult to remember how to conduct the ceremony. And it was through some regional cooperation where, you know, an archive could find some audiovisual record, a movie that had been made of a previous ceremony. It was only based on that they could properly conduct that very important ceremony. So, you know, there are cultural identity is at risk in the Pacific. And I think that there is an opportunity for Australia to you know, extend archival diplomacy. I mean, if Australia can assist in the preservation of cultural memory, of national memory, for all of the reasons that we've been talking about, it makes that community far more resilient. It contributes to stability in the region, you know, by having proper records of government records, for example, and proper government record keeping practices. You know, we are building stronger institutions in the Pacific, and I think we're also reinforcing a healthy relationship between our Pacific neighbours and Australia. You know, it's that sort of, they are foundations for good, positive, constructive relationships. I'm quite interested in, you know, the government of Estonia, you know, talk about national security, you know, threats. Well, Estonia has had some lived history with this, so lived experience, I should say, with this. So they have started to build data embassies, that they call it. So outside of Estonia, so in Luxembourg, for example, they have, under the Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Relations, they have an embassy which contains a data center, probably the embassy is within a data center in Luxembourg. And so they maintain their national sovereignty over this information, protected by the Vienna Convention. And their data, their national, the most precious data for that nation of Estonia, which is a very highly automated government, is maintained and protected through data embassies. Now, if we could do that, something like that for the Pacific Islands, a data embassy here in Australia with, you know, solid, you know, geology, you know, it's not going to be subject to earthquakes or whatever. We're pretty well protected from severe weather events. We have a pretty stable, you know, civil society. You know, we've good energy supply to keep the data center up and running. And these days with connectivity, that data would be in constant active use in the Pacific Island. And I think it's just these are certain ways that we could extend that level of assistance to our, you know, within the Pacific region. Because I think, you know, I'm repeating myself, I know, but for all of those reasons, if you want to build stability, if you want to have good governance, if you want to have strong public institutions, then I think providing a solid base for those records is a really good place to start. And as I say, it's a foundation for a very enduring and positive relationship between Australia and the Pacific Island state.
Well, I think on that practical, very regional-focused note, we'll end the conversation there, David. It's been an absolute delight having you with the National Security College, albeit virtually. If we were in person, we'd be giving you a big birthday cake for the archive's 60th anniversary. It's a remarkable milestone, and you know, I hope that despite lockdown, you and the archives are having a big celebration to mark the occasion.
Well, I certainly hope so. We'll concoct something.
I'd just like to say thank you very much for joining us, David, and thank you for enlightening the listeners on the process of the archives and how important it is to preserve the records, and how important it is for that idea, that the general culture of access to public information and access to our history.
No, thank you.
That's it for today. We hope you enjoyed the conversation. For more episodes like this, don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, thanks for tuning in.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.